Blog Talk Radio.
It's still crackling.
Crackling myself. How about that?
No.
No. Thank you.
Are you near a traffic light, Joe? Back away from that.
All right, I have to move.
Well, good evening, and welcome to another edition of The Man's Voice, a show about anything and everything we would like to talk about. And we hope that you are enjoying this Sunday. I know several places across the nation it has been quite hot. Now that the headquarters is here in Atlanta, we had 90 degrees today, so it's been quite warm. I hear a lot of noise going on. I think we have thunder going on somewhere. I think that might be Ron. But anyway, want to, since our panelists, since our last show, a lot of people have talked to me, sent emails, and so I'm gonna ask you a lot of, we're gonna talk about a lot of things that people have been asking me about. And so one of the things that seems to be a discussion item that I've gotten from several people over a period of weeks, and it's obviously coming from single mothers who are asking the question, how, at what age do we think a man should be settled down and has his stuff together? What age is it that a young man should be ready to get married? What age is it that a young man should be, you know, potentially able to make it on his own in society and leave the nest? Why don't you, Bruce, tell me what you think about that? What age do you think a young man should be ready to move on?
Well, I'll first preface it with the way the world used to be when I was that young, and that was around 21, 22, married, supporting, job, all of that. And really didn't think anything of it because that was kind of the nature of things back then. You went to college, you got married, people look at you now and go, wow, that's so young. So I would, with that preface, I would say that today's world, I think you ought to be ready to do all those things. This is a generalized statement. I'd say maybe mid-20s, another 5-6 years down the road than when I was married, but definitely before your 30s. Come on, guys.
So you're saying around 25?
Yeah, 25, 26, something like that. It's going to vary for different people, but as a general statement, to answer her question, I would say that.
Joe, what do you think? What do you think a person should be, a young man should be ready to move on and settle down, do whatever it is he's going to do with his life, or leave the nest?
I would say the sooner the better. I mean, a late teenager, early 20s, leave the nest. You know, I'm not saying get married. You may never be ready for marriage, but you got to be out on your own. I mean, if you have problems, you can always come back and try again later. But I mean, you know, you're a man. You're 19, 18, 21. You go out, rent out a room, or get your own place. Things don't go well. You can, always come back and give it another shot. But marriage is a different story. I mean, you're going to be married and raise a family. Maybe some men should never get married. Others are better at it.
I like to throw in a quick piece about going back. I know in my day when I grew up, my parents' rule was once you're gone, you're gone. You're not coming back. So be well prepared when you move out. What about you, Ron? What do you think?
Well, I kind of agree a little bit with parts of what both of the panelists said so far, but I don't think it's fair to put a number on it because people are ready at different times and there's so many different circumstances that affect somebody's upbringing. Maybe the parenting was not good or, who knows what it could have been. But, I guess as a general rule, if I had to if I absolutely had to put a number on it, I would say probably like around 21, 22 years old maximum. I don't think beyond that, you know, I think that's maybe pushing it a little based on, you know, the way things are nowadays.
So what about young men who are in college at 21? You're saying they should go off to school and never come back?
I think that's right. I think once they're off to college, if they're not commuter students, you know, not living at home, once they're off to college, you know, chances are that they've already decided that, you know, they're ready to make their own lives and start, you know, a life without living at home with the parents and someplace else.
All right. What about you, Frank? What do you think? What age do you think a young man should be ready to settle down and get his stuff together, move out the house, and leave the nest?
I think as soon as he's mature. For some people, that might be as early as 16 or 17 years old. And for some people, that might – right. So I think the other criteria is that if you're in school still getting an education, I would think that assuming you don't – if you live on campus, you should live on campus and probably go your way after you graduate. But, you know, I started off at 16, 17 years old, and I had to wait to get married because my wife wouldn't marry me until I could sign for myself at 21. But, I mean, look, get ready for life because here it comes. And, you know, wanting a family and wanting a child and having the ability to get a job is all factors. But your maturity is a big factor in that. And I guess if you're not growing if your maturity is slow, then you're probably going to be later. But I would say anywhere from 17, 16 years old up to 21 or 22 would be normal for me.
All right. I had a follow-up to that question because someone said, okay, yeah, I want to ask that question, but I also, if they say, you know, these ages, what's the follow-up is what should parents do to help their child get out of the home, get on his own if at 21, 25, 30 he's still there? Is there some way to help that child, or what does a mother do? What does a family do? What about you, Ron? What do you think?
Well, I'm repeating kind of what I said just a few minutes ago. I think a lot of it depends on the upbringing and the parenting that the kids have. So if they're still at home at 30 years old, I mean, that to me, that's a red flag. And I'm not a parent, but if I were a parent, to me, that would be a red flag. So I'm not really sure what I would do to entice a person that's 30 years old to leave my home, except maybe just have a frank conversation with them and say, you know, talk about, you know, why they haven't moved out, perhaps, you know, in a nice way without being confrontational, but just figuring out what's going on in their mind, you know, because who knows what the issues are.
Right. What about you, Joe? How do you help a person who hasn't quite got it that they should be out of the house and they're 30 years old?
My in-laws had that trouble. They had two sons. They were getting up in age. And the two sons were paying rent. And what these people did is they collected rent. And then this rent got to be like, you know, $10,000 over the years. And they said, this is your down payment on a house. They both had jobs. So here you go. We weren't collecting rent for ourselves, but for you. And here's the down payment. Buy a house and get your ass in gear. And that was it. I mean, how could the sons complain? I mean, they were comfortable at home. It was nice, you know? But then, you know, mom and dad also said, we got your down payment. You don't got no excuses now. Here you go. Out you go. So they kind of planned ahead for that.
Right. Well, that was good. Smart people.
Smart parents.
What about you, Bruce? What do you think?
Well, I tend to agree mostly with Joe and with I think it was Ron, but the part I don't agree with is I would like my parents did with me. They kind of expect once you go to college, you're kind of out of the house. I mean, you come back to visit and all that, but you don't really live there anymore. It's time for you to grow up. You're responsible. You're an adult. You're going to make a living when you get out with a career. You really not need to come back in that regard, because even if you pay, for me, even if I had my child pay rent or do a lot of things, and financially you were helping them save it for a down payment or not, actually making it rent, I don't think that sends the right message. I think I would probably sit down with them and say, you know, this is where it's time to put the boot to the bottom and kick you out of the nest. Not to be mean or cruel, but please understand, this is why. This is part of growing up. Here's my reasons why I think it's a benefit to you as my child. Believe me, it's not going to be easy. When my daughter left for good, I had a real rough time of it for about 6 months. It was rough, but it was what needed to be done. And I think the early 20s or out of college or whatever you want to say back, which is the way it was when I was growing up, I think is fair. If they're not going to go to college and are going to kind of either, heaven forbid, drift, I hope not, or go some other direction, there's still the possibility. If you're earning a wage and it's strong enough to live somewhere, whether it be an apartment or whatever, they need to do that. If you got to help them a little bit in today's market that's a little tough, then maybe temporarily do, because I think it's more important to make the break and that they move out and live on their own. They learn so many things that way, and I think that's an important thing that needs to start at the right time, and that's, like I said, 20, 21, early 20s.
All right. What about Frank? What do you think about the person that's still there at 30? The question is from a lady, what do you do to help the young man, you know, get out on his own? I think more women have a tendency to let the young man stick around. You know, we've always heard that mothers and sons, fathers and daughters. So I think women really have a hard time putting their sons out on the streets or in other apartments, or just getting them to move along once they're 30 years old and they're still in the house. So the question is, what do I need to do to help my son understand that he needs to move out on his own as a man to a woman, a single mom? What is it we would say? So, Frank, what would you say?
Well, let me just, again, I'm with the other guys. The earlier you can do it, the better off you're going to be as an individual. If you're in a super high cost living area like Washington, D.C. or New York or San Francisco, there may be some, you know, financial reasons with the cost of housing to be at home a little bit longer. But the people that I have seen at home after 28 and 30 years old and higher, in my opinion, have all been handicapped, severely handicapped. And I don't know that their parents don't know they're handicapped. I don't think they do. They don't qualify under a medical plan, but the problem is they're not mature, and it's not helpful to be at home to gain your maturity, because just like it was just mentioned, you learn so much by being on your own. And you also, when you're on your own, it's sort of like the gate closes behind you. In a lot of cases, you can't come back, or you don't feel like you can come back. So you're going to make better decisions than the individual that's always on the nipple, okay, so to speak, with the parents. So there's two advocacies. Advocate to be at home as long as you can, and when you got to go, you got to go. So it's incumbent on the parents to put that guy out or that lady out if they're employed, help them to find the employment and help them to set up their new dwelling so that they can learn life's lessons. But it doesn't do any good to wait till you're 3, 5, and 4 years old and finally try to get out. And I've observed relatives that are still at home and multiple, you know, brothers or sisters that are at home living with mom. And when mom dies, what will happen is they'll take over mom's property and won't even pay the taxes because they don't have the ability to understand what it takes to be competitive adult in this world.
Okay. All right.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
why do all of us panelists, and you too, David, why do we get the sense, I think I do, that the adults, the young adults, are staying home longer, want to stay home longer. This is a general statement. Than we did when all of us were growing up. Do you think that's true? And if so, why do you think so?
Well, one of the things I've noticed, I think it's how we are training our young kids. You don't see kids outside anymore. They don't go anywhere. They stay at home. They're complacent in this environment. They love it. That's their place. That's their spot. And I think, you know, they're not getting out like they used to. They're staying at home. They are growing up to be equals. And I find a lot of parents allowing their kids to be equals. And I think that's a problem. And I think that's something I've seen in several, you know, where you see them in the store saying, well, what do you think? You want to buy this? What do you want to eat for dinner? I will cook what you want. You know, and when we grew up, it was you eat what's on the table, yeah, or you go to bed hungry. it's the way they're training these kids to, and it's hard to get rid of them anymore. So what about Joe? What do you think?
I can agree with what you're saying, but I think part of like my parents, like part of being an equal is being a homeowner. All right, you know, the whole logic behind, you got to buy a house, it'll go up in value, you'll have a place. You know, it's like part of that, you know, crawl, walk, own a house. That's, you know, you got to progress. I mean, it's about change in your life. And you can be at home like a little kid, but, you know, hey, you're making money, you need to buy your house because that's part of life. You know, you can't be my equal unless you have your own place. Not a better place, but it can be.
Right. Ron, what do you think?
Well, I kind of agree with what you said. You know, I think they're just being brought up, in my opinion, not in the right way and differently than when I was raised. It was more like you said, you know, you either do it this way or you're, you know, there's the front door. Don't let it slam in your you-know-what. And I just don't think that's happening these days.
I'm concerned. Maybe it's not happening in single families, but I would say that it happens more in married couples, man and wife who has kids, that it's still that way. I think it's in single families that we see this, you know, you're the man of the house kind of approach. And I think that's wrong to say to a young man, you're the man of the house, so you have to handle these things. As man of the house, I get to stay here. You can't put me out.
Yeah.
What about you, Frank? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think the question you asked, David, repeat that again, please.
Well, what happens, you know, when the parent wants to know, what do you do to help a child get out on his own? And then, what is it that we need to do to express to the child, you know, that it's time for you to go? What do you need for me to help you go? How does a parent do that? And the child's 30 or 40 years old already. You know? And
you do, David, is first of all, you've got to make it so that the grass looks a little greener on the other side instead of staying home. See, it was just earlier mentioned, you can't give the child everything that he asked for because you're providing him an incentive so that he'll want to go out and be an adult, want to be married, and recognize that, you know, it shouldn't be a democratic system if he's living at their house. It should be a person who provides the bread and the butter and electricity should be in charge. And so that would motivate an individual to want to go out and make some decisions differently than what their parents did and have their own property. So I think that's, you know, you shouldn't coddle the person at home because you're not helping them to be an adult. You're not helping them to be ready for the workforce. And so you should give some incentives that are tough to that person, so that person might say, you know, I've got some alternatives, and I'm not going to take your deal, Mom and Dad, and stay under your covers and under your roof. I'm going to go out and do my own thing.
Okay. Here is a follow-up question that came about. Obviously, this didn't have a name on it, but it's anonymous. But it, the question, I would assume, came from a woman, because the question is, does a man have more responsibility when he's married, newly married, to his wife or to his mother? It can get you in a lot of trouble. But, Joe, what do you think? Does a man in a marriage have more responsibility to his wife or mother in certain issues? Or is it exact that the wife is the leader in those issues?
I'd have to say overall, I think the wife comes first. But at the same time, you know, you got an old lady, an old woman, her needs or situation can be taken account of. I don't really think it's a lifeboat situation where you got to toss one over that's going to die. It's not that. Your loyalties and your time should be with your wife. I mean, I don't think you can spend 23 hours with mom and then spend an hour with your wife. No. And I think financially, you know, unless your mother's living in the house, it's with your wife and family. So I'd say wife first, with consideration for other family members.
In that question, there was a point that said, ask the panelists, what if the mother needs financial help, but the wife says no, if the husband's mother wants money, and the wife is saying no, you give her too much money or something like that. Who takes priority? And I guess it depends on the relationship and everything, I know, but this is a question that was asked to us to kind of discuss. So what do you think, Bruce?
Well, I think like anything else, I agree with what was said. Your wife comes first. You have a new team that's been developed, wife and husband. And don't forget that. Now, you don't have to be a horse's you-know-what to make that break. And part of being kind or understanding about that is you better be very good at sitting down with your wife and getting and helping her understand as much as she needs to help you understand the new roles of parents. Because grandparents, you know, they're going to be grandparents probably too. So, you know, in your question about the son's wife, if you really feel there's a valid reason where you need to help her temporarily or whatever, you need to sit down with your wife and if she says no initially, you better do a better job of explaining and possibly getting her to understand, because you start fracturing each other and going against each other's decisions as a team right off the bat, you're starting off on the wrong track. That's not good. You really can't do that. Not if you want to have a strong, successful marriage.
I have a follow-up to that. It says, what about if the mother needs physical help? I guess if the mother wanted to, is deteriorating physically and the son wants to bring her in the house and the wife says no, who has priority over what, you know? And I guess let's have that conversation. What do you think? What do you think, Bruce, about that? No, I'm sorry. Let's go.
I had that situation.
Okay, go ahead then.
I had that situation years ago, and what we did, because we had talked about having her, having an apartment built for her attached to the house or whatever, you know, living with us. And we decided together, after back and forth, yeses and nos, that it would really be better for our new family, all things considered, that we can help her, but she's not going to live with us. Because there's so many commitments to each other first, to get the marriage off, I think, on solid ground, understanding, love, all the things that should go with the start of a solid marriage or starting to build a solid marriage. And the parents really shouldn't be a big focus in that. And you know, if she lives with you, she's going to be. And we finally decided that we would help temporarily in that regard, finding her a place where she could get some assistance on a temporary basis, but she was fairly close. So kind of best of both worlds, but maintaining the new family unit. I think that's extremely important that you maintain that unit, that new unit.
Okay. Joe, what do you think?
You know, I think it depends on the family. I mean, you don't want a situation where there's a competition between mom and wife. I don't think there's anything you can do to make that good because somebody wants to win. But for myself, my wife's mother was 92, and I said, you know, she can live with us. We got the extra bedroom. You know, we can bring in the caregiver in here. I mean, she's family. And I'm a firm believer in taking care of family, whether it's a mother that's got a few months left or it's a kid that needs his diapers changed. I mean, family first. And you're part of my family. You're my wife. You're family. You can, you know, you can be the top woman if you want to be. I don't care. You can be the top person of the whole family. But family, if you take care, I ain't going to throw my mother into the street.
But Joe, this is Bruce. What if?
Go ahead.
What if she says, Joe, in crude language, ain't gonna happen, Joe, for these reasons? Then what do you do?
I have an answer for that.
Great, okay, thanks.
sorry, Joe.
Go ahead.
My answer is, you know what? From the relationships I've been in, which come and go, as we know, I mean, there's very few relationships that last forever. But mothers do, and you only have one mother in your entire life, I would say that family comes first. My mother would come first.
Well, all right. What are you making your new wife? She's family sub one?
If my new wife is making me choose for a non-valid reason, and of course we'd have to figure out what the reasons are, but
yeah,
if you would make me choose between her or my mother, I would kick her out sooner than you can blink an eye.
Oh, wow.
This is Frank. I agree with that last statement that was made. First of all, you shouldn't marry. That's why you get married early on, so your mother is still young when you're married, and then when she needs help later on, you're able to get it because you got a solid marriage relationship because you haven't been selfish, and you recognize if you're not selfish that you're going to help your parents out because they helped you out, right? And your wife is somebody that you love, but you shouldn't have to choose between your mother and your wife unless, you know, either one of them are terribly bad people. And most mothers aren't terribly bad people. They provided nourishment and protection for you as you're going up. So, again, most people shouldn't marry someone that doesn't like your mother. Okay, that's not a good recipe for success. And you should care for your mother because that's biblically provided for to do that. So, again, you're right. I would that would break up a relationship that I had, and I know a lot of people that are suffering from that type of situation right today.
Wow.
And that they're not married. They won't marry the other person because that person doesn't like the other person's married. And further, I agree, if you can't put the person in the bedroom like Joe indicated in your home, then you can do what a lot of people do. You can build a house onto your house, or you can build a separate house dwelling unit that's on the premises or close by. But you should be there to help your mother.
All right. Okay. I want to move on to another question I got, and this was, I thought, very interesting, and I wanted to have the discussion with the panel. And it's the question is, why do men, when you talk about birth control, men don't think about it as a man thing? It is a woman thing. And of course, you know, guys can't get pregnant, but, you know, common sense would tell us that a partner surprise pregnancy can be like a life major stressor for both the male and the female, with potential and mental health impacts. So have a question from a young lady, want to know why we don't, as men, think about birth control, and we don't teach our sons about, when we think about birth control, we think about it as a woman's job, not a boy and girl's problem. Why do you think that is, Ron? If you think it is.
Well, I think it's simple. I think it's because you know, a lot of men, or maybe most men, are selfish, and they are all about the pleasure when they're engaging in sexual intercourse, and they want, and you know, everybody knows it, when you use a protection, you don't feel the same kind of pleasure. So I think that's probably a main reason why.
What about you, Bruce? What do you think?
Whoa. I don't think I can be as bold as Mr. Ron. yes, I suppose you could consider yourself as selfish if you think more of yourself than her, because I've always preached that if you're in the right relationship and or marriage, you think of your partner first. You really do. Yeah, our guys tend to think, well, I can't get pregnant, so it's not me, which is the wrong thinking altogether, because it takes the two of you, or at least that's the way it was traditionally done. I think, you know, you've got to respect her and say, you know, what are we going to do? However, I'll be very candid and honest, I wouldn't want to be clipped and tied. I'm just being honest. Maybe another way, but not that. And I can't really tell you why. That's just something I don't want to do.
But the question is, why don't we talk to our sons or other men about this issue? And why don't we say that it is a two-piece issue, not just a one-piece issue?
Hey, David, I'd like to contribute to that, okay, because I have a viewpoint that's probably going to be different, but let me just say this. First of all, you know, based on my religion, okay, that type of birth control issue, other than the rhythm method or other than a natural method, is not something that you want to teach your child to do or to perform, okay? So I like to work on the responsibility issue. If you're going to mess around and have sex, then you should be doing that, if you're going to do it, with someone that you plan to be married to, or don't do it. All right? If you end up having a child, then you need to be responsible for that child. Okay, and that means you need to provide support without being requested to do so, and you need to be a parent to that child. So I think that one of the problems are, and I understand what was previously said by everyone, but I think you need to be prepared as an adult that if you're going to have sex, you need to step up and be prepared for the consequences. And the consequences are is that you need a job, you need to provide for your child, and you need to provide emotional support for the other half. And you need to know that when you're having sex, that the probability are that's going to be the result. That's the math in that. So, but I would not teach a child that you should use condoms or whatever. I would make sure the child is aware that, you know, for protection purposes, but it is not in accordance with my faith belief.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Joe, what do you think about that?
Well, to me, it's simple. You're a sexually active woman. You better be on the pill because it's the best thing. It works great. And who knows, maybe you have multiple partners, maybe you just have one, but be on the pill because it's easy peasy. I'll pay for it. Now, if we get married, I'm going to cut my balls off, and you don't have to worry about the pill because I cut myself snipped. But that's how it works. But till I get married, I'm full of vinegar, and it's coming out, and that's the way it's going to be. You be on the pill. You get the ring on your finger. I'm, you know, after one or two kids, I'm going to snip them. That's the bargain. That's the deal.
Joe, tell us how you really feel.
That's a softball. That's a softball question to me.
But Joe, why aren't you? So you're saying that for your kids, your sons and stuff, you're telling them to be what's that term? The wild seed, grow the wild seed. Whatever that is. Telling them to go out there and just do it.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're a young man, you need to be careful. I mean, some women want to get pregnant, you know. They don't care who you are. Or you're at your own. I think the nature of the question was, you know, that there's going to be birth control. I think that's how I understood it. I think it's up to the woman because of the pill is so easy. And then after marriage, snip it. Yeah, if you're a young guy, I mean, you know, you want to take that risk and get pregnant with someone you don't even know, maybe you should invest in a condom.
Right. All right. Anybody got any more comments on that?
No, I want you to go to Joe first each time.
Well, I need some time to think about it.
I would love for Don to be a part of this conversation tonight.
I wish.
Oh,
yeah,
where is he?
He had a church thing that he had to go to, so he's not here. one of the issues that we have as men, I think, is when you have a house full of daughters. There was a question that was sent to me to ask the panel, who has the sex talk with young girls when you sit down and supposed to have the talk? I don't know a lot of people that sit down and do this. Sit down and actually have a talk. I think it's kind of general conversation that happens over a period of time. I don't know if people still just sit down and have this birds and bees conversation anymore, but maybe they do. But the question is, who in a family should do the talk? And the more importantly, the question was also, should a man sit down with his daughter before her first date and have a talk about the sex talk? What do you think about that, Ron?
Well, I'll just start off by saying I'm 53 and I never had the talk from my parents, so I don't think it's a new thing. You know, the lack of having that conversation, and in terms of who should have the sit down with a girl with a daughter, in my opinion, I think that would be best coming from the mother. If it's a mother that's a good mother, obviously. And then with the boys, obviously, I think the father would be most ideally suited for that.
Okay,
no,
let me ask
reason.
You this question. What if it's a single mom? Who has the talk if it's a single mom and three boys?
Well, then obviously I think it would have to be the mom. I mean, because that's the person that's bringing them up to be responsible citizens in this world, and who better than that person to talk to them about, you know, being responsible when it comes to being sexually active.
So you're saying it's a 13 year old young boy should sit down with his mom and have the sex talk?
I personally don't see anything wrong with that.
Okay. Bruce, what do you think?
Well, I think, as Ron said, you've got to go with the adult influence in the family, if that's the most appropriate, is dad, if he's there for the son, and probably the mother, again, if they're responsible parents with the daughter. And if there's a single dad raising the kids for lack of divorce or being widowed or something like that, or a single mom, then at least attempt and talk about the subject to some degree as best you can as the parent. You know, not, and the gender kind of has to take a second seat if that's the only choice you have. I've always thought it a little curious, or wondered a little bit as to why we think our kids seem to be a little more promiscuous in this generation than we were. Or am I going to get in trouble by saying that?
Right.
I don't know if that's true.
I think it's more open. It's more open.
Oh, yeah, maybe that's it. Yeah, that's it.
A follow-up to that question is, what age do you think the sex talk should be given if it's, you know, a parent to a child? When do you think? And I kind of think that it should be an ongoing thing. You know, it should be something that is comfortable having all along. And then one day you finally say, let's sit down and talk about this thing when they're, you know, when they're going through puberty, and you need to talk about condoms and all those kinds of things. And the
Dave,
for Joe. Yes.
David, this is Frank.
Yes.
You know, for me, how it's folded out is my uncle was sort of like Joe, and Joe's comments. So I got an in-depth understanding of, or starting to get an in-depth understanding of the sexual relationship between young people. And so I would recommend that you consider that also. That's what probably godfathers are supposed to be, and that's what uncles often have done for me. And I think you start your process as early as 10 years old.
No.
What about you, Bruce?
What about?
What age do you think we should have the conversation with our kids? Yep.
I would say because they're being either exposed to the discussion or in other ways way earlier these days, I would tend to, as Frank said, probably much earlier than I would have thought necessary, but probably if not 10, somewhere, you know, 10, 11, 12, even before they're even a teenager.
All right.
At least start the dialogue.
Right. What about you, Joe? What do you think?
Well, I think it depends on each family. I mean, you might have these people with religious beliefs. It's not going to happen until you're married, so we don't need to have the talk. Or, you know, some feel that, I don't know about a specific talk. With my own son, I don't really think I ever had to talk with him. It's just that when he became sexually active, he'll ask me a question or two, like how to do something or, you know, how to handle a problem sexually, and I'll give him an answer. But I never, I don't know about giving, I don't even know what the birds and the bees, I know what the birds and the bees is about, but I don't actually know what the story is, how that worked.
It's okay, you're not alone, Joe.
Yeah, the birds and the bees, you know. I don't know. I think it depends on the family, and you know, probably I know of one family where the mother and father became sexually active became a couple at 16, and then married, and now they have children, and their 16-year-old daughter has a boyfriend staying over in their house. They allow it to happen because they say, well, that's what we did. I guess, you know, we're not hypocrites. I mean, it's
okay.
Different for every family.
Hey, David.
All right. Yes.
I was just going to say quickly, like what Joe said, that the son came to him. I think if the parent and the child has a strong enough relationship and bond, the kids will come to the parents and ask the questions naturally, you know, without it having to be an artificial, you know, picking of an age where you have the talk. I think it just happens naturally.
All right. Well, a lot of issues about relationships that we've been getting. People want to hear what our thoughts are on relationships. But I want to change the cue just a little bit because tomorrow is the debate between the Republicans and Democrat presidential candidates. I don't know how, and we've had this discussion a lot, and we haven't discussed it in a while, but I don't know how the Republican candidate is the Republican candidate. But anyway, what do you think about the debates tomorrow? What do you think we're going to find out? What are we looking for? What should we target in the debates as something that should be something that we as men should be interested in hearing? What do you think, Frank?
I think, as I've said before, I think that Donald Trump is a bigot. I won't. All right? And so if I was Hillary Rodman Clinton, I would not even be at the debate for him because I think there's no benefit of her having a debate with a gentleman that's basically a scoundrel in my mind. I will say this right here, that in regard to my personal feeling is that I think that and I've never called him anything more than a bigot, okay? But I think that the world is in grave danger based on his emotional way of doing business in regard to our nuclear survival. And so if he wins the election, I don't think he's going to win the election. But if he were to win the election, I think it's a great threat to world survival. So there isn't any questions. I know that Mrs. Clinton was married to the President of the United States. I know that she's a senator from New York State. And I know that she's been working as a Secretary of State. And I have the confidence that she's going to maintain reasonable world relationship with other countries, which those countries are very important to our survival. I know that she's going to maintain relationship with various groups of people, such as minorities, such as Hispanics, such as people that are LGBT, and various different communities. She has respect for those communities. And I'm comfortable with that. I'm not comfortable with the person running in the Republican Party, and I have voted Republican, but I would not vote for any group of people who disparage another group of people, because that is not a civil relationship, and when you disparage people, you are then inviting anarchy and war. So that's I couldn't think, you know, I'm going to be watching it like probably 100 other million people are that day. But again, I think the person that's running against her and supporting the other party is not even being supported by his previous presidents that are surviving right today. And that tells you something, okay? So, again, what's important for me is to find out when the election is all over how many people voted for this guy, whether he wins or lose. That would be my personal interest and our personal survival as a nation.
All right. What about you, Bruce? What do you think about the debates tomorrow? What are we looking for? What do you want to hear from the candidates? What is it that should be happening tomorrow?
Well, the last part is it hits it kind of on the head. What should be happening tomorrow is these are the two people that have been put in position for our choice for president. We may not agree with how they got there or what they represent, but it's the way our system works, and we have to respect that. I think it comes down to, and what I'm going to be listening to very carefully, I just hope, because it's happened so infrequent thus far, that the two of them, both of them, they're both guilty of not doing this, trying to get and just talk about the issues and get clarity on what they stand for and how they got there or how they feel the way they do. I don't want to hear this back and forth about she's bad, he's bad, all of that. That's child's play. Be adults. Tell us what you stand for. We're intelligent people watching this. We're going to vote to put you in or not, and that's what I would look for. And I would add one more thing. I think this election, as different as it is, and I do think that, is a struggle between the system the way it is now and a system, right or wrong, that might turn it on its head and start over again. In many ways. So it's more about old school, new school approach than anything else. And these are the two people that represent those two ideas. And I think it's either going to be an extremely close election or one of them is going to win by a huge landslide. It's kind of not committing to much, but I think one of them is going to win big, and I'm not really sure which one yet.
Ron, what are you looking for tomorrow from the debate?
Well, you know, I honestly can't wait. I mean, I've never been as excited as I am now about a debate. As Frank said, probably 100 million people, as many as watch the Super Bowl, will be watching tomorrow night. And I'm thinking everybody's watching for more or less the same reasons, you know, because we like the, you know, and I know Bruce said, you know, it's child's play, but we like that. You know, we like to see, and I'm generalizing, of course, maybe speaking for myself, but I like the candidates to challenge each other, and, you know, obviously that's always going to lead to some contention, confrontation. But, you know, in terms of what we should be listening for, I think what I want to get out of the debate tomorrow is substance, you know, in terms of foreign policy and things like that, and the economy. And I, you know, so far Donald Trump has been mostly evasive about, you know, specifics. Or he'll say, you know, he's going to hire a team, and in 30 days they're going to come up with a plan. Well, you know, that's just not good enough for me anymore. Not that it ever was, but I also have to say that I'm a little scared, because I remember when we first aired, like, one of the first couple of shows, we were pretty much not maybe in consensus, but many of us panelists agreed that it would be impossible for Donald Trump to be the presidential, the Republican nominee. And here we are today, you know, with him standing a very good chance of winning. And, you know, nothing against him personally, but I think if he wins, you know, as leaders from around the world have been saying, you know, we would be the laughing stock. And I think, you know, I agree. I mean, I think we're headed to another world war if that's the case, you know, if he ends up being president. I hate to sound so dramatic and drastic, but, you know, people around the world don't respect him, and they will not respect the U.S. if he's elected president.
All right, Joe, what do you think about tomorrow's debate? What are you looking to hear? What do you want to come away from with it?
I am a enthusiastic Hillary supporter, but, man, is she dull and boring. She can't tell a joke. She's not funny. She's not entertaining. Trump, ridiculous. But you want to talk about him, you know? He's strange. And I think Hillary, so tomorrow, is Trump going to be ridiculous, and how Hillary going to handle that? And Hillary presidency, she's going to hit the ground running, knows all the people, and she's going to run it. Trump, if he's president, I don't think there'll be a problem as long as he delegates. He's going to have other people run the country. He's going to have Cheney's do everything. He ain't going to do squat. He might make a difference in one or three things that'll be really great or really horrible, but, you know, he's going to have Ryan and Pence do all the hard work. He's just there for, you know, the face. But I'm waiting to see how ridiculous Trump's going to be and if Hillary can take advantage. But we ain't going to hear anything funny out of Hillary. She's dull and boring, although she's the best person for the job.
All right. Well, tomorrow, I guess we'll all be listening. 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific, and in the middle there, those of you that are in Mountain Time and all those other times, I guess you can look it up. But something that came to my attention, do you know that California is voting on not changing their daylight saving time anymore? They're just going to stay at one time. And so if there's Eastern time and Western time or Pacific time, I guess it will be California time. I understand there is another state that doesn't change also, but California is going on in November will be voting for whether they want to change the time or not. What if all the states start doing this? Do you think that's a good thing or bad thing, Bruce? Or do you think we should be changing time at all, Bruce?
Well, I think we ought to look at more than just the convenience or inconvenience it may cause each one of us. I think you need to look at all the things. I would want, if I was in the position of changing that or agreeing or disagreeing with it, approving or not approving, I'd want to know, you know, how does business see this? How does government see this? How does commercial operations, interstate commerce, all that sees this? So that you really get a full picture. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, it'd be good for me, then I don't have to worry about it. Well, that's kind of selfish in my mind. I think we've got to look at all that are major affected by a change like that or or keeping it at one time and then decide.
Ron, what do you think?
I say let Californians choose whatever time they want because they're going to split off from the U.S. when there's another earthquake and be their own island. So let them choose whatever time they want.
Ron, let me just throw in this. When I was in Florida, there was this big announcement that by 2040, that the father state, the southernmost state would be Georgia, that Florida would be underwater. So you might need to move too, you know?
I'm planning on buying a house in Atlanta soon.
What do you think about changing time? So you think California could do what they want to do because they're not going to be around that long, right?
I was joking, but you know, I don't see it as a problem. You know, so what? Let them change the time. Who cares?
Well, they don't want to change the time. You're like, why change time? We're just going to stay one time, and that's what we are. You know, I think the reason for changing times originally was because that's when farmers were getting crops and they needed more time, you know, to work and all those kinds of things. But now that they're not doing all that anymore, is it really necessary to have daylight saving time and time changing back and forth? What do you think, Joe?
Well, David, this is Frank.
Okay.
The previous reiterations of that have been in regard to saving fuel. So, and maximizing our daylight exposure, which saves us money. So if we're still going to be a nation that's observant of good utilization of Earth's resources, then we're going to have some type of manipulation of the clocks to afford the best uses. So that's currently why we use a daylight savings time, is so there's daylight out there and we get people out in the workplaces and we don't have to use the electricity as much and fuel as much. So I don't know what they're going to come up with, but I do know that there are some places that do not use this standard time change, and there are some places that have their own time thing, but I would prefer to have a time that always says it's 6 o'clock in the morning if it's daylight. Okay.
Right.
And I would always like to have a time that extends to the latest hour, you know, that you can get daylight from, which would be 7 o'clock, let's say. So that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. Joe, what do you think? We should have time. I know you're in the mail business. What do you think? We should do time changes or not?
I think Frank kind of answered for me. I'm not real sure. Like that thing about the farmers, that's why we have summer break for school. I agree with Frank. Right. I think Frank covered it pretty good.
Okay. We've only got a couple of minutes left, so I have a question that a young listener sent me, and she said, it used to be my mother would say the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. But in schools today, we learned that a way to a guy is to talk to them. So, but what do I say to guys when I talk to them? So quickly, can we just move around the table and tell me one thing that you think young men would like to hear from young girls talking to them? What do you think, Ron?
You have to pick up me first. I think just that they're like a really caring and loving person. That's what I would like to hear and you know, be reiterated by them.
Okay. What do you think, Joe? What would a young girl need to tell a young guy these days?
I think I just need flattery. I need someone to boost my confidence with a woman, and if she's doing it, that makes me feel good. And a young girl tells you nice things.
All right, Frank, what do you think? Quickly.
Well, I think the girl should know that the chase is on, and she's the one being chased. That's what I think she should know.
All right, Bruce, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there needs to be, the caring back and forth. It's not just about food. I want to feel important to her and vice versa. So That makes it pretty simple for me.
We're down to the last 10 seconds. I want to thank everybody for listening in. You've been listening to The Man's Voice, panelists from around the nation, and we all talked about things. We hope that excited you enough to call us and talk to us next week. Remember, you can always call in and give us your opinion on the topics that we're talking about, but then we hope that you have a wonderful week and enjoy the sunshine, because it's going to go away pretty quick. And in the debates tomorrow, listen, and as we talk about it again next week, give us your opinions. Thanks, guys. I will see you again next week.
See you guys. Have a great week.
Have a great week.
All right.
Yes.